This is KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. It's time for Issues and Ideas, a show that features a wide variety of local voices sharing their thoughts and perspectives. Today, we'll hear about the use of fungi to remove toxins from the soil following a fire.
We introduced Pleurotus ostreatus, the oyster mushroom, which has been shown to be able to hyperaccumulate metals and biodegrade, you know, plasticky stuff, to see if we can use them in this situation.
Also, we'll hear from an author of a new novel, which highlights the roles of women in California's history.
And they could stay with their husband or not. If they owned property, they could own it separately from their husband. It gave them an agency and sort of a power that allowed them to help build California.
These stories and more coming up on Issues and Ideas. Good afternoon. It's Monday, May 10th, 2021. I'm Carol Tangeman. Livestock grazing services are becoming more widely used as a fire mitigation tool. Animals clear vegetation and reduce fire risk, especially in hard-to-reach places like the slopes and hillsides of the Central Coast. KCBX's Beth Thornton reports.
Jack Anderson is working with his dogs to round up a flock of sheep. He is co-owner of Kuyama Lamb, LLC. They have about 450 sheep that graze the foothills of Santa Barbara County. He says his organization is hired to clear low-growing plants like grasses, shrubs, and mustard.
We will build temporary electric fence in a place where we're contracted to remove vegetation. Then we'll bring in a group of animals. They will graze it down.
Anderson says they continually move the fences, so the animals graze through the acreage and clear about 70% of the vegetation, leaving the area more protected from fire.
And then we'll build another little section and open it up, and they'll walk into that one, and sort of on a daily move, the herd will migrate across the job site.
Anthony Graham works for Kuyama Lamb and coordinates jobs at multiple sites. He says with the help of a few loyal, hardworking dogs, he herds the sheep from place to place on land or loads them into a trailer for longer distances.
Depending on the size of group that we're shipping, it could take all day.
Kuyama Lamb began as a business for restoration of native California grasslands and ethical farming. The sheep grazed orchards, vineyards, and ranches. In 2018, Anderson says they expanded their services to include fuel reduction.
That was the year after the Thomas Fire, and so there were a lot of conversations in this area about how we are going to manage the fire fuel loads in this region.
Those fuel loads, or the amount of combustible material, contributed to the Thomas Fire becoming the largest wildfire at that time in modern California history. That fire and the subsequent mudslides in the Montecito burn area drew international attention. Kuyama Lamb co-owner Jenya Schneider says grazing for fire mitigation purposes needs to happen routinely to keep fuel loads down.
It takes regular impacts, whether it's every year, every few years, and then that will also manage for reducing the amount of dead material that builds up over time.
Another benefit, she says, is the trampling of the soil by the animals' hooves.
Just in their moving around the landscape, they'll walk through all these dense shrubs and trample that dead material. And once it comes in contact with the soil, there's often enough soil biology that will actually decompose back into the soil.
According to Schneider, the use of livestock for fuel reduction is growing on the Central Coast.
Locally, we're seeing our community wildfire protection plan discussing how to use grazing as a tool. And we're in conversation with many of the local fire departments.
The Montecito Fire Department hires the sheep for areas that are difficult to reach with hand cruiser trucks. Maeve Juarez is a wildland fire specialist with the department.
Oh, there's some really steep portions of the district that we had always wanted to treat but weren't able to necessarily get in there.
Juarez says Montecito includes livestock grazing in their community wildfire prevention plan and says most fire departments in the area recognize it as a valuable tool.
It's an attractive option as it's shown to be ecologically and economically sustainable management tool. And the sheep and the goats actually prefer the steep and rocky terrain and the slopes that we see along the Central Coast.
Whether to use cattle, sheep, or goats for grazing depends on the vegetation and environmental impact desired. For instance, the Pismo Preserve is currently using cattle and goats for invasive weed control and fire mitigation. If you are interested in livestock grazing services, the Central Coast has a variety to choose from in Santa Barbara, San Luis Obispo, and Monterey counties. You can also contact your local fire department. For KCBX, I'm Beth Thornton.
When a massive wildfire tore through the Santa Cruz Mountains last year, it destroyed close to 1,500 structures. When a structure is destroyed by fire, toxic materials can leak into the environment. Cleaning up these spills often involves scraping the earth and dumping it somewhere else. But a local group is trying a different approach. They're experimenting with fungi, which they say has an incredible ability to remove and even heal toxic burn scars. KAZU's Michelle Loxton has more.
I meet Maya Elson deep in the Santa Cruz Mountains on a property perched on a steep slope overlooking a creek. It's hard to imagine, but someone's home used to stand here.
Right after the fire, we came here and everything was gray. You could hardly see anything green, and there were just piles of rubble and ash.
Elson is the executive director of Co-Renewal, a nonprofit that uses science to tackle environmental issues. This heartbreaking scene inspired them to get to work.
You could see aluminum that had been liquefied and had dripped down the hillside.
Elson was very concerned these toxins could make it into the creek and spread throughout local ecosystems affecting fish, animals, and people. That's where the mushrooms come in. They decided to try something called mycoremediation. Myco meaning fungus, and remediation meaning returning to what it once was.
We introduced Pleurotus ostreatus, the oyster mushroom, which has been shown to be able to hyperaccumulate metals and biodegrade, you know, plasticky stuff, to see if we can use them in this situation to remediate these toxins and trap these toxins.
Co-Renewal's volunteer mycologist, Erica Schroeder, took me through the process. With a spade, they dug a shallow ditch horizontally along the slope, then placed a long wattle in that ditch. A wattle is a tube filled with compacted straw. The wattle is then sprinkled with mushroom fungus or spawn.
The oyster fungi will then start to eat and consume the straw and move along the wattle, creating a filtration device.
Essentially, they're making a living sieve. And that living sieve will filter water that moves down the slope and take out the toxins. To monitor just how effective this process is, the team collected samples above and below the wattles at the start of the experiment and will do the same at the end, a year or two later, to check whether the mushrooms decrease the amount of toxins at that site. The oyster mushroom spawn that they used in this experiment is very specific. The Co-Renewal team is introducing a fungi that is native to the area. They got that from a local mushroom grower in Moss Landing.
We grow 12 different varieties of mushrooms. We do shiitake, tree oyster, lion's mane, maitake.
That's Kyle Garoni, the production manager at Far West Fungi. He says Moss Landing is the ideal place to grow mushrooms because of the humidity and the climate that doesn't fluctuate too much. On a tour of the facility, we peek inside the different shipping containers where pink and yellow oyster mushrooms are growing under a gentle spray of irrigated water.
They have a really nice, crazy-looking color that most people think, like, well, what did you do to these mushrooms?
Garoni said they donated the native mushroom spawn for this experiment to do their part in helping the community deal with the toxic consequences from last summer's wildfire.
Fungi have been used in that way for decades.
Gregory Gilbert is a mycologist and professor of environmental studies at UC Santa Cruz.
But it's not as extensively studied as it probably could be or should be.
He says because fungi live inside what they eat, some of them have this amazing ability to take in toxins and either use it for energy or convert it into something less toxic.
Now, it depends on the fungi. It depends on the toxins. It's not a universal fix for everything.
Gilbert says mushrooms and fungi are tremendously diverse in what they can do, abilities scientists continue to study, like the healing of wildfire burn scars.
That was KAZU's Michelle Loxton reporting. The COVID-19 vaccination site at Cuesta College in San Luis Obispo has been administering around 1,000 doses every day to county residents. This week, the clinic will operate on 2 days only. KCBX's Rachel Showalter visited the clinic and spoke with some of the people who make it possible.
1,000 shots a day is the goal, but site manager Kevin Coomer says their record is 1,132. Coomer says the clinic is surpassing its goal almost daily because of the more than 65 nurses and volunteers who show up ready to work every day.
We're here to have a welcoming spirit, tell them it's going to be okay, and we get them through the program with this least amount of anxiety and fear.
Coomer says San Luis Obispo County doesn't have enough medical care employees to provide vaccines this quickly, so the clinic is supported by traveling nurses from a company called Snap Nurse. They come to the county for up to 120 days from places such as Texas, North Carolina, New York, and Louisiana. Coomer says the volunteers and nurses work to keep operations smooth in order to get people in and out within 45 minutes.
We try to make it as simple and organized as possible. So if you come in, it's all confusing, you don't know where to go and it doesn't make sense, your anxiety level goes up. If you come in and you start with the huge sign that we have above the first table, say vaccine start here, that's a start. They know exactly where to go, the anxiety level decreases right from the beginning.
Volunteers direct people where to go from the minute they drive up. The clinic is divided into several areas, including a place for initial paperwork, 14 vaccination stations, and spaces to sit and wait after receiving a shot. Coomer says one of the traveling nurses who makes the clinic such a great place to be is Kevin DeJean. Coomer says DeJean's positive energy is infectious. DeJean says he likes to keep people happy while they move through the clinic.
Hey, when we started today, you know, I literally asked the crowd, are you ready? And they're like, yeah. I'm like, no, are you ready? I mean, it gets the crowd wild. You're pumping up their blood system. They feel excited. And that's what I want to do. I want to take out the nervousness and that fear.
DeJean came to San Luis Obispo from Georgia on a temporary contract. He expects to be on the Central Coast until his contract ends in June. He says he wakes up every morning grateful for a new day, and he makes it his mission to bring joy.
I live by a code now. My code is to make smile and love contagious. You know, my thing and my job every day is to wake up and give someone a better day.
He says he likes to connect with the people getting vaccinated and help them relax.
Yeah, ask them how their day's going, and depending on their, you know, response and how they're moving, I start humming a song. And the songs becomes to, you know, the humming comes to singing, the singing comes to the dancing, and they're like, oh, I like that song, or you sound great. And it takes them out their comfort zone. That's literally what I do every day.
Many people help keep the site running on a daily basis. Volunteers at the clinic are registered through the San Luis Obispo County Medical Reserve Corps, or MRC. Bethany Hall is a Cal Poly student studying biomedical engineering. I spoke to her when she was helping people at the clinic who needed wheelchair support.
A lot of what has come with COVID has been really sad and kind of a grieving process, and this is definitely a joyous time of turning a new page and seeing a brighter future with these vaccines getting distributed.
Debbie Lyon is another volunteer with MRC. She's a retired dentist and marriage and family therapist and has spent time at several clinics throughout the county. Lyon helps keep the lines moving and acts as a translator for Spanish speakers who show up to get vaccinated.
Anything you can do to help with the pandemic, you know, people feel so helpless being, you know, kind of at home or isolated, and it's like, you know, what can I do? And this is something that anybody can do.
Ben Belize is another volunteer that comes to the clinic about once a week. He says he loves seeing the vaccination progress each day he's there.
Stepping back and looking at the big picture, it's nice to have a really small part in this massive movement, which everybody wants. We all want to get it done with this thing. You're sharing this call to morality.
To sign up to be a volunteer, you can visit the Medical Reserve Corps website. The County of San Luis Obispo has 3 vaccination clinics in Arroyo Grande, Paso Robles, and San Luis Obispo. As of April 30th, nearly 148,000 doses had been administered to county residents. More than 64,000 people had been fully vaccinated. For KCBX News, I'm Rachel Showalter.
Appointments are now limited to Wednesdays and Fridays at the Cuesta College location, and there are lots of options for getting a vaccine. San Luis Obispo County is offering walk-in vaccinations in Paso Robles and Arroyo Grande. To make a COVID-19 vaccine appointment and to find more information about walk-in hours, visit the website recoverslo.org. For vaccine information for Santa Barbara County, go to readysbc.org, and in Monterey County, check co.monterey.ca.us. Vaccines have been open to everyone 16 years and older in Fresno County for a month now, but demand for the vaccine is now declining. Latinos are the majority of the population in the county, but they only make up about 36% of people who have received at least one dose of the vaccine. KVPR's Mari Bolaños went to the Cherry Auction, the swap meet and cultural hub of the Latino community, to see what stops some Latino residents from getting the vaccine.
It's a warm Saturday morning in South Fresno County. The song Carta Jugada by Banda Tuxantla plays as families and vendors bargain at the Cherry Auction. It's the Central Valley's largest outdoor market, with endless rows of vendors. Latino residents have come here for decades to purchase clothing, blankets, produce, and much more. The music is coming from 27-year-old Alejandro Gonzalez's CD stand. Gonzalez and his family have sold CDs here since he was 8 years old.
It officially became mine when I was 15. My dad passed away and I took over the stand.
He says selling CDs is a dying business. He's even considered an exit plan a few times, especially during the pandemic. The Cherry Auction never fully closed in the past year, but he says there were a few moments where hardly anyone showed up.
There was a week that was really tough.
He has other jobs during the week, but he relies on their sales at the swap meet to make some extra cash to support his family. But with COVID cases declining in the San Joaquin Valley and vaccines becoming more available, things are looking up, he says.
Now that it's opening up, I can tell that people are excited to buy. People want to come and buy.
But for the county to safely reopen, public health officials need to convince more people to get vaccinated. A recent poll from the Public Policy Institute of California finds that 20% of people in the Central Valley won't get the vaccine. It finds the region has the highest rate of vaccine hesitancy in the state. In Fresno County, Latinos are the majority of the population, but they only make up about 36% of people who have received at least one dose of the vaccine. Gonzalez says for him, getting the vaccine was about protecting his family.
My mom, well, obviously she's a little bit older, and I want to make sure she didn't get sick. And at the same time, I have a sister that's pretty sick, and I want to make sure that I put myself in a position where I don't pass that over to them.
His wife sells small toys a few aisles down, and his mom sells perfumes and colognes at a stand next to him. Gonzalez says his mom was hesitant to get the vaccine because of what she had heard from Spanish news outlets and social media sites like Facebook.
After speaking with her directly, she understood logically it's reasonable to get a vaccine. Like in everything we consume in our body, there's always risk.
She got the vaccine, but others at the swap meet are still hesitant. Marla Gonzalez is here with her husband and two kids. She came to the swap meet to purchase a faja, or waist trainer, used by some women to give the illusion of a smaller waist. She says she doesn't have plans to get the vaccine anytime soon, especially after hearing that health officials briefly paused the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine last month, following reports that six women who got the shot developed blood clots.
Because a lot of people still haven't taken it either. And well, also with the news of them pausing the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
She hadn't heard that the CDC had allowed the Johnson & Johnson vaccine to be administered again, and admitted she doesn't pay much attention to the news. When she does, she says she doesn't hear good things about the vaccine.
In Univision, that people have died from the vaccine or that they had strong reactions to the vaccine.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention currently say there are no deaths directly attributed to COVID-19 vaccines. Gonzalez says she might take it if it becomes a requirement at work. 32-year-old Ana Saucedo is here with her three kids. She says she contracted COVID while working at a distribution warehouse in Fresno. She says the company was incentivizing people to work more hours back in December.
They were doing like this $1,000 bonus if we stayed at work for 10 days for 10 hours.
so people didn't want to miss on that, so they were coming to work sick.
That experience convinced her to get the vaccine, but her husband is still not ready.
He just doesn't want to feel the symptoms. He thinks he'll, like, instantly feel symptoms receiving the vaccine.
Saucedo's parents are also hesitant about getting the vaccine, but for other reasons, she says.
My mom just says that she thinks they're just testing it on people right now.
On the other side of the swap meet, 45-year-old Rafael Cisneros is making balloon animals for kids in exchange for tips. He's a roofer, but he learned balloon art in 2008 when the recession hit and home construction ground to a halt. It's come in handy again during the pandemic, he says.
I make about $60 because the balloons come out to $12 a bag, and I bring about 5 bags, plus the space I pay for here, which is about $28, plus gas, and I bring my kids, and sometimes they want something to eat.
His 4 boys watch him from the shade as he makes swords and flower balloons for other kids. Cisneros says he's ready for the pandemic to be over so he can return to working on roofs full time. But he's still not sure about getting the vaccine.
I've heard that it gives you blood clots, and that's why people don't want to take it. That's why I'm waiting, because if I get it and that happens to my blood, then I have my kids, and well, what am I going to do?
Like others, he says he isn't completely ruling out the vaccine. He just needs more time.
That was KVPR's Mari Bolaños. There's a new monthly series of Zoom events put on by NAACP Slo County, Know Your Rights. KCBX contributor Dr. Consuelo Mukes has more.
Welcome to the Nonprofit Story. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host. Knowing your rights during this time period of COVID-19 is more important than ever. Today, I have 2 people from the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People to talk about the Know Your Rights series that is being presented by the NAACP in San Luis Obispo County. I have President Stephen Vines with us this morning, as well as the attorney Madeline Nance, who is the Legal Redress Committee Chair for the NAACP in our area. And I want to say welcome to both of you, and thank you for taking time to give us this important information today. I tell you, there's so much going on right now with COVID-19, a lot of changes in the laws, a lot of changes in how people are functioning. It's important to get updated. So let's start by first getting a view again of what is the NAACP, and then we want to talk about the things that you're doing to help people stay informed. So President Vine, can you tell us what the NAACP is and what you are doing right now at this time to help us to navigate our way through COVID-19?
Well, you know, the NAACP is a, should we say, social justice organization. We fight discrimination and segregation. And, you know, we fight for everybody. We fight for all people. And when you look at color, everybody has melanin, so everybody's colored. We are really a human liberation organization. And being a human liberation organization, you know, one of the major things that we do antagonism, education, we do litigation, and we do legislation. We fight on all five fronts of how you move the ball forward and to deal with the main issue, and that's policy. And, so what we're trying to do with our Know Your Rights issue is our education component. And so that, you know, when you know better, you can do better. I'm really excited, you know, that Madeline, you know, came up with the ideal, and her team came up with the ideal to do that, because, you know, that's what we do. Because if you know better, you can do better.
You know, you named a lot of areas that the NAACP is involved with. In our local branch here, do you have people who are involved in these different areas? As you said, legislation and litigation and policy. How is it formed? And that are you able to touch on these areas?
Well, the NAACP, we have some 25 different committees. We deal with every area of human, should we say, interaction in a sense. And we look at, you know, first thing we do when there's an issue, we bring the issue up, and that's antagonism. And then, you know, and then we have our committees, for example, the Legal Redress Committee, which goes across all of our committees, because when there's issues that has to deal with law and taking action as far as litigation and following policies and procedures, our committee deals with that as far as for housing, it deals with for employment, it deals with young people, with church, I mean, with religious organizations, it deals with a full range. And all of our committees basically have oversight within the community. We're the only organization, really, like the organization we have, with such a full range of breadth, you know, inside our community.
I want to move on to Attorney Nance, Madeline Nance. She is the chair of the Legal Redress Committee for our local branch of the NAACP, and welcome to the Nonprofit Story. Attorney Nance, tell us about the Legal Redress Committee. What do you do and why is it important?
The Legal Redress Committee, as President Vines has already so effectively stated, is one of many committees on the NAACP organization's bylaws. And we work sometimes in tandem with other committees, such as housing or criminal justice, just to give a few examples. But our primary mission at the Legal Redress Committee is to investigate all complaints that are reported to our local branch of the NAACP. So as President Vines was saying, we're an anti-discrimination organization. We're very much focused on that issue. And a lot of times we have reported to us incidents where individuals would like us to conduct an investigation where they claim that they have been the subject of racial discrimination or some other form of discrimination, whether it be gender, sexual orientation, religious, etc. And our job at the Legal Redress Committee is to take a look at that complaint and conduct our own inquiries. We are independent in that sense. We do not take a side at the beginning of the inquiry. We're objective, and we investigate, and we meet and discuss the results of our investigation. And if necessary, we take steps to address what might very well be an injustice of some sort. And sometimes that's reported to our national organization. Sometimes we look for resolution with a mediation type alternative. But that is our job at the Legal Redress Committee primarily. And all complaints to the organization go through our committee. We do not give legal advice. I know that is a common misconception, understandable one, but still it is not the case. We do not give legal advice. We will always refer people, however, to resources when they need them. And we will do that as expeditiously as possible and try to find them or help them find the legal advice that they need in certain situations. We also monitor and in some cases, if we're involved in any local litigation, supervise that litigation. And of course, we work very closely with our state and national offices. We are required to do so because we are a local branch. And so we all have to report to our national and state an NAACP what's going on in our locality. And of course, we have our own distinct issues here in San Luis Obispo County and the surrounding regions. And those issues we keep very close watch on. We talk about in our committee and we decide whether or not we need to pursue, get involvement. We discuss that with national, obviously, if that's what we feel is necessary. Again, we keep close tabs on things that might be going on in the community that may need to be addressed at the litigation level.
And so, are we finding that within our county, you are actually having a lot of issues to address?
We have had complaints brought to us. I have been chair since the beginning of this year, January 1st, 2021. President Vines perhaps could speak better to what complaints may have been made previously, but during my tenure, there have been a handful of complaints related to racial discrimination. And of course, we've looked into those. There are very much issues that need to be addressed, however, within our community, we find. And that's what our organization is here to do. And that's what the Legal Redress Committee is trying to do for our community.
It's important for people to know that there is some place to go if they do have an issue, and they can call the NAACP here in our area. And we're going to let people know how to be in touch with you so they can look at the legal redresses that they may need to address here. And if you are just joining us, this is The Nonprofit Story. I am your host, Dr. Consuelo Mukes. I am speaking with Stephen Bynes, the president of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People here at the SLO branch, and attorney Madeline Nance, who is the chair of the Legal Redress Committee. Let's get back to the Know Your Rights series. I know you just had a wonderful presentation recently on Know Your Rights as a Tenant. You can talk to us a little bit about that and then also tell us what's coming up that you're going to be presenting.
Yes, so we in the Legal Redress Committee and of course the greater NAACP local organization believe that it is extremely important that people be empowered with knowledge about their rights. And toward that end, the Legal Redress Committee has decided we should have a series of events over the course of the summer and probably into the fall of this year regarding specific timely issues. And so we just recently had a housing forum. It was entitled Know Your Rights, Fair Housing. We had it this last Thursday evening, May 6th. And it was basically a presentation and some discussion from our local nonprofit organization, SLO Legal Assistance Foundation, SLO LAF is the acronym. And we had Stephanie Barkley and her colleague, Sadie Weller, both attorneys, both staff attorneys. Stephanie Barkley is actually the director of SLO LAF, and they did a wonderful presentation on fair housing issues. They covered a number of things. They covered basically the right to fair housing in general and the right to be free from discriminatory practices in housing and renting situations. So, for example, there cannot be discrimination for disability purposes, for religious purposes, for, of course, race cannot be a factor in any way. And they discussed that at some length. They also talked about the right to relief and how to access that, the resources available when someone feels they have been subject to housing discrimination. They talked about the right to habitability and safety in one's housing. Habitability simply means the right to live in a nuisance-free and safe environment. Mm-hmm. And they talked about what specifically can constitute a breach of that right. They talked, of course, extensively as well about recent eviction laws, changes in the law that most recently have happened during COVID.
I think there's a lot of changes coming with this, and they gave a wonderful amount of information, including the California Senate Bill 91, a very complex topic, and we are going to need to take some time to really flesh that out. Is there a way that the people could hear that particular presentation so they could get all of the details?
We're doing a series, we have our website, and one of the projects that we're working on is NAACP TV. Our goal and objective is really to have a digital access to education. And we're going to be having a lot of programming in a lot of different areas to make sure that our community, as we said, if you don't know any better, you can't do better.
And that's so true.
That's one of the themes of our NAACP, our San Luis Obispo County, is to make sure that people, have access to the information they need to make good, sound decisions and to keep our community a positive community when it comes into all areas. So, that's one of the things we're doing, NAACP team. I'm excited about that.
Yeah, well, that sounds exciting all the way. So on the television area, then, will you have these types of workshops so that people can go back and take a look at them?
Well, our goal and objective is we're going to launch on Juneteenth. We're going to launch our NAACP on Juneteenth. We're setting up the website for it, to interact with our main website. And then we're going to start building content. So setting up our programming, our daily, our programming. So we're in the process. We'll probably start off with small programming, and then we're going to fill it to 7 days a week, 2 hours a day, and then to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and then on to 24 hours for 7 days a week that you can always look at programming and get information that you need.
In the meantime, our housing forum that was just done on the 6th can be accessed on the website, naacpslow.org, and there will be an uploaded, the recorded session of the presentation we were just discussing from May 6th. And we're going to be having a Know Your Rights Forum on June 24th via Zoom at 6 p.m. called Equity in Education, where our panelists, also local attorneys, will be discussing education rights. So we'll be talking about special ed. We'll be talking about special circumstances such as immigration status, again, discriminatory practices, and how to protect oneself in those types of situations. And of course, on our website as well, the complaint forms are there, and every complaint has to be done in writing, and that's very important. That's why we have it easily accessible on the website. There's a few other forms that have to be completed that are informative in nature, but nonetheless, that also have to be signed. And then that complaint comes to the Legal Redress Committee. So I just wanted to point that out very quickly before we forgot to do that.
Is there a certain place to find it on the website, or is it right on the homepage?
I believe if you scroll down on the homepage, it is very easy to find. It should be fairly prominent.
So we just got a new person that's going to be taking over our website and revamping that. So we're in the process of updating our website, but you still have access to it, but it's just going to get better and better.
Would you still like to have more members? Do you need more members? Do you need more assistance on some of those committees?
Yes, most definitely we do. We're a four-year-old organization. You know, when you look at standard organizational process of an organization, it usually takes, like a business, 3 to 5 years for an organization to be up and running. We got our membership, we got our leadership, and we are now is to get our committees filled because the breadth of things that we do are so wide. And since we get paid $1 million per person and committee head, you know, thing we do is volunteer. We all have jobs and we all have businesses and we all have our lives also. So the best way to be able to do that collectively is to have more people. The more people you have, we can spread it out and everybody won't get burned out all at once.
Can you just give us one more time very clearly the website URL so people can find you?
Okay, our website is naacpslocty.org.
This has been the Nonprofit Story. I'd like to thank Stephen Vines, the president of the NAACP Slo Branch today, as well as attorney Madeline Nance, the NAACP Slo Branch Legal Redress Committee chair, for informing us today on so many different issues, including about our branch, as well as the Know Your Rights series. We want to thank you, and hopefully you'll join us for that. Thank you very much. This is Dr. Consuelo Mukes, your host.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cal Poly grad and author of the award-winning novel Prospects of a Woman, Wendy Vorsanger, talks with KCBX contributor Tom Wilmer. Vorsanger shares insights about the book and her work chronicling exceptional women throughout California's history, featured on her blog, She Is California.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting. Right now, we're with Wendy Vorsanger.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your book was a game changer for my study of California history. As we both know, it was approximately 5% of the population in the Sierras were female, 8% in San Francisco. So by default, 98% of California history was written by men. It was an unconscious bias. All of a sudden, you come along and you show me the gold rush through the eyes of a woman. My first question is, why and how did this all start? Was it a vision? Was it an epiphanous moment for you?
Well, I'm very interested in California history. Mm-hmm. I was born and raised on the American River. And when my kids were young, I would bring them up to the North Fork and kind of just get their energy out and play around. Or I would take them up to the Yuba. And I spent a lot of time on Highway 49, taking them to the little towns, going to the museums or into the mines. And I started thinking a lot about who the people were that lived in these areas. And then when they got a little bit older, my boys in fourth grade, they have to learn about the gold rush. Right. And women are absent from that narrative in our California school curriculum. And I was very surprised by that because I knew there were women here. And I went about trying to understand who those women were and what they were doing and what their lives were like. And I was very surprised at everything that I learned, because I realized growing up in California, I really didn't learn anything about the women of early California.
So you decided to change the rules of the game. Your protagonist is Elizabeth. How did you come up with her? And is she a prior incarnation of you?
Oh, my goodness. I don't know. I don't think I'm as brave as her. Well, I did a lot of research about women in early California, and it was very easy to sort of create her because there were so many different women who were actual women.
So most of the women in the book are modeled after real characters?
Yes, all of them. All of them actually are real characters. Some of them I actually changed their name. She's an amalgam of four different characters, four different actual real people. I started to do the research and I was like, wow, these women are really incredible. Like, for instance, Frances Gearhart, she was a woodcut maker and a printer. And Ina Kohlberth, she was an early California poet. You know, it was very easy for me to learn about these women and learn about their extraordinary contributions and their personalities and what made them different than women in the rest of the country. And once I understood, wow, these women were not the same type of women that were in the rest of the country, then I started to dig deeper. What was giving the women this agency? And then I learned about the laws of California and the rights that women were given.
Oh, that was an epiphanous moment. I did not realize what a game changer California was when they had their statehood. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is really fascinating. And this is something I really wish California school kids would learn. In 1849, when the California Constitutional Convention happened, there were six California men there. And those were men that were very powerful, part of the land-owning, ranching families in California. And they basically insisted, they had a seat at the table, and they insisted that women actually had property rights and that they would put that into the Constitution. Property rights and rights to make contracts. Property rights separate from their husbands or their fathers.
What an anomaly.
Yeah. And that was happening nowhere else in the country. And the reason why, there are a couple of reasons for that. So in California, our law comes from Spain. It comes from, you know, the civil law. It doesn't come from, you know, English common law. So the American immigrants that were sitting around the table basically agreed to it for one reason. They said, okay, we'll stick that in our constitution because we want the women to come. So that'll get them here. That'll be the big magnet. That instantly was embedded into the constitution. And then right after that, once we became a state, all the counties started allowing women to get divorced and to keep custody of their children.
Wow. What a disconnect at that time and place in America.
Right. But it set the foundation for the way women were treated, number one, and also how they viewed themselves, because all of a sudden they landed in this place and they could stay with their husband or not. If they owned property, they could own it separately from their husband. It gave them an agency and sort of a power that allowed them to help build California.
The other dynamic in your book was you managed to make it timeless. You gave it, in a sense, a contemporary lens. For example, Elizabeth's husband turns out to be a homosexual. You know, that's stuff that, for the most part, was not talked about. But you reveal that. And lesbian issues, you know, a lot of those dynamics that you know happened, but yet we don't read about in California history.
Right. So that's another sort of narrative that's missing from what we're taught in schools and in sort of films and early, you know, pulp fiction of California. And when I started doing my research, I realized that especially in the southern mines down by like Sonora, that was a much more raucous area, kind of wild area, lawless area. And there were groups of men down there that were able to sort of live more honestly. And I believe that that set the foundation for sort of the freedom that many gay people have in California now.
But it's an untold legacy.
Yeah, there are some academic books actually that have come out in the last, you know, 20 years or 15 years that do sort of explore that. And I saw many photos and illustrations that inspired a couple of scenes from my book, which were very surprising to me. Like, I didn't understand, oh, these men were dancing with each other. They were being with each other. They were pretending. They were taking on roles, right? I didn't understand, oh, how come I don't know about this?
But even like in Australia, it was so man-centric that that's where the term mate that is still used in Australia. The other dynamic had to do with the Mexicans, Californians,
yeah,
that lived here. The rancho down by Gilroy. What was that modeled on? How closely on reality?
San Juan Bautista.
Where in your book.
Right.
Where, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I
the hacienda where she
right,
goes to.
Right. So interestingly, I have a close friend who has a little place on the North Fork of the American, and he also has a place. So in the very beginning of the book, where the book takes place in the beginning, and the end of the book where it takes place
right
down in that region down by San Juan Bautista, he also has a house down there. So it's geographically, it's exactly the same.
Mm-hmm. Story-wise, contextually.
Yeah. I mean, for me, that whole area, the Galvalian Mountains mm-hmm. range, it's so rich and beautiful. And the mission down there is just extraordinary. Have you been down there to the mission?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's so
and actually, fourth or fifth grade when you do California yeah, history, yeah. That's where we went
oh, really?
On our bus field trip.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. So to me, I really wanted to tie those two areas of California together. Mm-hmm. And the Spaniards that came here oppressed the Native Americans, right? Then you have the Mexican-Spanish War. The Mexicans now take over. And then the Americans come in and we systematically go about removing their ranches from them. Mm-hmm. And many women married into ranches, many men married into the ranches, American.
To get rights.
To get, yeah, give me some of that yeah. money, right? So I felt like that was an important narrative in my novel to explore that I have not read in other narratives or fiction.
We're talking with Wendy Vorsanger, the author of Prospects of a Woman, a novel about the Gold Rush era in California. Tell us more, Wendy.
So I get a lot of questions about the sex in mm-hmm. my book. I can yeah. tell you, we can talk a little bit about that.
Contemporary and very timeless.
Right, right. I appreciate you saying that. I wanted to make the history of California women accessible. And I also feel that from personal experience, you know, I have a lot of women in my family going back many, many generations that to me always seemed very confident and very comfortable with their body. I do feel like that felt different for me from other women that I've met in other parts of the country. So I wanted to explore that. And I felt like from what I researched, that was a very authentic narrative for women in California.
So you found some primary source
oh,
material?
Yes. Yeah, and I have to say
So they were diaries or what did
yes.
you?
Yes, yeah. And the most interesting wow. diaries for me, by the way, were from the men. And actually not diaries, I don't want to say. They yeah. weren't diaries. Letters or men, I found up in the Gold Country, I would find sort of records, right, of men. Men mm-hmm. would say, okay, this was the weather today. This is how much gold I had. And my wife came and threw the lamp against the curtains and my cabin burnt down and I can't get her back. What I found most interesting was the narrative from the men because that illuminated a lot. And not that they were really emoting in mm-hmm. these sort of journal type accounts, but they would talk about the frustration that they couldn't keep her. She won't stay here. Why won't she stay here? She's always leaving. Or now I hear she wants, you know, this guy down the road who has a bigger claim, or mm-hmm. she wants to open something up in town. Or now I hear she's baking bread, you know, over the hill. And that was the most illuminating to me, I think.
That's one of the dynamics of this gold rush that's so amazing is how much people earned per hour to iron clothes or to bake bread.
Right.
Yeah. And you have your bread baker in your book.
Yeah. And I would love to talk a little bit about that woman. I don't know. Do you know anything about her?
No, I don't.
Okay. So let me tell you. So I have a character in my book named Nandy Gooch, and her real name is Nancy Gooch. And she came here in 1850 with her slave owner from Missouri. So it's almost a actual narrative of her life. So when we became a state in 1850, he was run out of the town of Coloma on the American because you had to work for yourself. You couldn't actually own people in California. And she stayed with her husband and they were free. So they started doing all kinds of domestic work. They cooked, they did laundry. They started saving up their money, diligently saving up their money, and they started buying land. And they ended up paying for her son's freedom in Missouri and his wife, and they came out to Coloma. She ended up becoming one of the largest landowners on the river. not the largest African-American mm-hmm. landowner, but the largest landowner.
Of everybody.
Yes.
Wow. That's so cool.
Yeah. And her family and her descendants are buried in Coloma.
Wow. Living descendants?
I don't know, actually. Oh. I'm sure there are. Yeah. I'm sure there are. But, you know, she's a woman of color, yet she still had agency and power, not just that she wouldn't have had in the South, but she wouldn't have had as a white woman in, you know, Missouri or Kentucky or wherever. And I found that really, she must have been an extraordinary woman, but California gave her that strength.
Think of another game-changing character that you bumped into.
So Juana Briones was amazing. I don't know, do you know anything about her? So
nope.
She's also modeled in my book.
You know, this is another book.
No, you mean all these women? You mean the real women?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm trying to chronicle these women online. It's mm-hmm. She Is California. I'd like to get more women up there, but I have 50 women. So
Where do you go to?
SheIsCalifornia.com. So my idea is to kind of get a chronicle of all of these women, not just the women who were doing extraordinary things, but the women who did sort of minor things to sort of help build California. But anyway, so Juana Briones is really a fascinating character. She is the California woman in my novel, Gabriela Sanchez. So I basically just took Juana's life and threw her in there and gave her a different name. So she was a California woman who was living in San Francisco, sort of at the base of Telegraph Hill. And when California allowed divorce in San Francisco, she divorced her husband. He was quite abusive. They had a small rancho, and she did a lot of like healing of American sailors when they sort of came in on their ships. And she had 7 children. So she ended up leaving that area and buying a huge ranch down in Los Altos area. Mm-hmm. She ended up becoming one of the largest landowners down there, rancher, woman, single mom, 7 kids, like really quite an amazing woman.
Elizabeth, she came from the Northeast.
Yes.
What was the modeling there?
Well, I felt in order to tell the story of California women or women who came to California and became California women, I really wanted to have sort of a mirror of what were women doing on the East Coast. And so my character comes from Concord, Massachusetts.
Based on a real person, or was it kind of composite?
It was a composite, mm-hmm. but in my novel, her childhood friend is the real Louisa May Alcott. So I was able to take that real woman who was living on the East and had, for her time, a great deal of agency and power in terms of, she was the breadwinner for her family. She wrote and was able to support both of her parents and her siblings and sort of compare, well, what would a woman like that be versus a woman on the West Coast? And so in my novel, my character writes Louisa May Alcott letters. And in those letters, it's in first person that you're able to sort of see how they interact with each other. And to me, that was an important part of the mm-hmm. book.
And it is. It's kind of like a little aside. You're reading your novel, and then all of a sudden, you're reading her letter to Louisa May.
Right. And also what I did is when I wrote the letters, I did a lot of research about Louisa May and her life and her family and sort of how she felt as a woman trying to become independent on the East Coast. And it was very, very difficult at the time. And in the letters also, Elizabeth has a different kind of way of interacting with her girlfriend on the East Coast. She tries to really put on her East Coast self, if you will, in her letters.
Right. Yeah, you could tell the whole shift in word usage.
Yeah. She kind of tries to up her game a little bit.
Right.
Things are a little scrappier out here in California.
The other thing, your book has all of the requisite ingredients that Hollywood looks for.
Yeah.
Every single one. Are you under contract yet for
Not yet.
Are you working on that?
You know, it's interesting. I have some people who've reached out to me, but nothing is kind of spinning yet.
It is such a visual, dynamic story
right.
that you tell. It's just, it's begging to be a visual story.
Yeah,
in movie form.
I mean, to me it is too. I feel, mm-hmm. so have you watched this new show on HBO called Warrior? Or actually, I don't know if it's on HBO, but HBO just picked up the 3rd season. This show is the first show I've ever seen about early California that gets women right. 1870,
okay.
It's set during the Tong Wars in San Francisco. And it's all Chinese, California, American writers, producers. They get all of the Caucasian women perfect. So I would love to work with those people. Yeah.
The other thing that you touch on thematically in your book are the Native Americans.
Briefly,
yeah.
right, briefly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I actually had a sensitivity reader work with me on that. There's hardly any Native California women who've been able to get their story told in a book. And so this isn't that story, but if you talk about California women, you have to talk about Native California women and sort of what their plight was. And so I touch on that briefly. Yeah, Nisian was the tribe, but I was very careful and I did work with a sensitivity reader.
So how have you been showcasing your book? Do you do book talks and go around?
So because of COVID, my publisher put the book out in October, right? And because of COVID, I've been super isolated. I haven't been in any bookstores.
So you've been doing Zoom?
Yeah, it's all been Zoom, which has been fascinating, really interesting, because I do a lot of book clubs. I love doing book clubs. I have a presentation that I do on Zoom, which shows a lot of the visual inspiration for the novel, and people seem to really like that. And then I've done a lot of radio and podcasts and weird Instagram Live, Facebook Live, you know, doing a lot of that stuff. So I'm mostly just trying to appreciate the fact that the book is actually out in the world. And yeah.
Where does Wendy go from here?
So I'm also really interested in sort of the artist colonies in the 20s. You know, there were a lot of artist colonies, one near Carmel, one by Big Sur. There was, and then right there in San Francisco. So in my family, there were a couple of women artists that would, you know, leave their kids at home, take off in the afternoon, go to their studio, quote unquote studio. So I'm very fascinated with that.
And that's how Carmel Art Colony started, was from the San Francisco earthquake. So
Yeah, so I'm fascinated with that and sort of what the women were doing, what they were creating, what they were leaving, what they were sacrificing, right? So I've been doing a lot of research around that, but then I'm hearing, oh, sequel. So I'm not sure.
One is you're going to be working on Prospects of a Woman, part two. Then when you go cross-eyed, then you jump over to women in California history.
But my boys are like, you need a Prospects of Men. And I'm like, I don't really think we need that.
No, there have been way too much of that.
I just want to say one thing about men in California. I think that because of how women were given power and agency in early California, that's been challenging for men, right? And and I think men have had to be had to up their game. And I do think the men in California actually, as a result, are patient, tolerant, open in ways that they maybe they aren't in other states.
Wendy, if somebody wanted to learn more about you, where would you direct them?
My website, which is just my name, wendyvorsanger.com or .net. Wendy Vorsanger, V as in Victor, O-O-R-S-A-N-G-E-R.net or com. And then also, if you want to learn more about California women, sheiscalifornia.com is a good spot to go.
I'm so glad that you came to the studio, and it was an honor to meet you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
We've been speaking with Wendy Vorsanger, the author of Prospects of a Woman, a novel. And I'm your host, Tom Wilmer.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX Central Coast Public Radio. Gary Eyster composed our theme music. A special thanks to all our guests and contributors this week. I'm Carol Tangeman. Join us each Monday from 1 to 2 in the afternoon for more local stories. You can head to our website to learn more about what you heard today or to listen to past segments. KCBX.